Hey there, beautiful people. Olga Peters here with a quick note. In today's conversation, we will be referencing a speech given by former Governor Dean Davis. If you want to hear an audio version of that speech, head on over to our podcast page, the MontpelierHappyHour.captivate.fm. And Emily Kornheiser did a wonderful recording of that speech. Also, in the show notes at the same website, I will link to a text version of that speech. Enjoy. Hello, beautiful people. Welcome to this week's episode of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEWLP Brattleboro. I'm your host and producer of the show, Olga Peters, and this is where we talk about how everything in Montpelier shakes out for the rest of us. Unfortunately, regular contributor Emily Kornheiser had a work conflict and she couldn't be here today, but I am happy to welcome back to the show Amanda Gustin, who is the Director of Collections and Access at the Vermont Historical Society. And we are going to revisit something that Emily and I call learning from your political ancestors. And we will be talking about the farewell address of Dean C. Davis, Governor Dean C. Davis, as it appears in the Journal of the Joint Assembly, 1973. And I will link to the show notes to that full address. It's on the Secretary of State's website. Whew. Hey, Amanda. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me today.
Well, thank you for coming back to have this conversation, because as we were saying before the show, this is a very, very meaty farewell address. And I think it touches on a lot of things that we will be dealing with in the upcoming session, such as what is the Vermont quality of life? You know, what does that mean? Dean Davis was the one who spearheaded Act 250, and we're revisiting that right now. He is also the one who started the sales tax in his first term. And what I find so interesting, and you also mentioned that he helped reorganize state government as we know it now. And what I find so interesting about all these things is we take them for granted now. And yet, when you think about it, this speech is 1973. It's 51 years ago, which, depending on how old you are, does not seem that long ago. But for all those big changes that we now take for granted, it really wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, it's a blink of an eye in terms of United States history, in terms of Vermont history. It feels both settled in stone and not at all in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, like the sales tax. If you had asked me when did Vermont start its sales tax, I'd be like, probably the 40s or 50s, maybe even the 30s, right? After the Depression, and no.
Yeah, yeah. It's in his first term, so 1970.
Mm-hmm. So for you, Amanda, what do you feel? Because it also stood out for you, that question of what is the Vermont quality of life? What stood out to you when he was talking about that?
Yeah, so I'm sort of endlessly fascinated by this question, right? This, like, what makes Vermont, Vermont? What makes a Vermonter a Vermonter? It's that question of essentialism in history. And we touched on this a tiny bit more the last time I was here, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you define what is good quality of life and what is good quality of life for Vermont? And he offers some ideas of his own. You know, he says in this address, he describes some physical characteristics, open spaces, friendly hills, wooded terrain, gurgling brooks, and solitude. And he also says, or it is an attitude of mind. And he goes into this whole sort of description of early Vermont settlers, of course, completely leaving apart the fact that there were already people living here.
Yeah,
but he sort of adheres to this, right? He adheres to this founding father's way of looking at the world, which, like, for a man born in 1900 who lived in the spaces that existed in the spaces they lived in, makes perfect sense that would be his worldview. But he he sees a certain continuity with what he argues for a founding sense of, like, well, it's right there in the state motto, right? That freedom and unity, both a sort of sense of self-reliance, each man, and he probably would have said man, on his own land, farming his own land, but also helping out his neighbor. It's that eternal central tension of what does it mean to be your own person, but also live in community. And I think he, generally speaking, I was telling you before we started that I've been rereading sections of his autobiography. Generally speaking, I think he probably erred on the self-reliance part of that, on the freedom part of that. But he also, as we described from some of the policy accomplishments, very keenly understood the sort of the power of government to bring about sweeping change in people's lives and to make big things happen, which is a version of the unity piece of that freedom and unity. So the fact that he leads his farewell address, essentially, this is in the first part, with understanding that some of the fundamental problems he faced during his administration were actually questions about what the Vermont way of life should look like in the future, I think is really interesting. That's a really kind of a meta thing. Like, you don't necessarily see that many governors summing up their, he had two terms, right? Summing up their tenure in such a metaphysical kind of way. It's fascinating to me.
Yes. Well, it's funny you bring up freedom and unity, and I'd love to segue just briefly there. A couple weeks ago, Emily and I had a little debrief on one of our episodes. We just sort of needed to get some things out of our system. And one thing we were talking about was freedom and unity. And what does that mean? And so I'm curious for you, just as an individual and someone who loves history and knows more than about Vermont history than I will probably ever know. You know, what does that mean to you? Because it's not a small thing, freedom and unity.
No, I honestly, the more I've been thinking about it, I've been reading a lot from people sort of theorizing, what does it mean to live in community? What does it mean to be in a, quote, in a society? For me, it describes what I've been thinking of a lot as a creative or a productive tension, in that in all things, there needs to be a productive tension because that is how we move things forward. And I think recognizing that productive tension that is at the heart of so much of human interaction, how much do I get to make decisions completely about myself and how much of those decisions actually often entwined with other people? And when does the which way does the pendulum swing on the impact that my actions have on other people, and when are they only impact on me? I was having a conversation this morning with someone about, okay, well, if I feel a certain way, like, when does it start to affect someone else? And that's a really hard line to draw. And I really deeply love that Vermont just names that right in our motto. We lead with that. We lead with, yep, we know this is hard. We know this is a really tough thing for all of us to navigate as we move forward. And it also, they're eternally separate too, right? There is no perfect balance. Mm-hmm. There is no complete on one side or the other. They are always together and they are always, as I said, in tension with each other. I love that.
Oh, thank you, Amanda. Well, that might become one of our regular questions here on the Happy Hours. What does freedom and
Good
unity
question.
Mean to you?
Yeah.
No small things. You know, one thing about this speech is, while I realize Davis was stepping down, it does feel like he is giving it at a point in time where Vermont's shifting and things are changing. And so I was wondering if you could take a couple minutes and just sort of set the stage of, because you're nodding, so I'm guessing you feel the shift too. Set the stage for us a little bit in that point of time.
Yeah, sure. So Dean Davis is governor from 1969 to 1973. This farewell address is January of 1973. He's passing the torch to the governor-elect, Tom Salmon, who had previously been the Democratic minority leader in the House of Representatives. Dean Davis, and I'm fascinated by this. He's born in 1900, so very neatly you can tell what age he is at any given like moment in Vermont history. He was 9 years old when he was in the first Boy Scout troop in America that was founded here in Barrie City. He grew up in Barrie City. I feel like I should name that, being from Barrie City myself. He was at Theodore Roosevelt's speech when Theodore Roosevelt came to do a stump speech in Barrie City, right? He can point to himself in that picture there.
Oh,
So
that's
he,
wild.
right. So he is raised, his father is an attorney, but he's raised partially on his grandparents' farm in Corinth, but back and forth between Barrie City, so an emerging sort of world over the 20th century, but also this older Vermont farming. So he embodies in his life, he is an obsessive horse owner. He breeds Morgan's horses and is obsessed with Morgan horses throughout his entire life. But he also is a very high-powered attorney throughout his entire life. He's general counsel for you name it, up to including the National Life Insurance Company. So that's my way too long preamble way of saying that his life sort of embodies a lot of the 20th century shifts of Vermont. And as we get closer, he's always involved in politics on but as a sort of more of a political person, he's not really in elected office as much. He actually comes to the governor, apart from he's a city councilor here in Barrie City, he's Washington County State's attorney, and then he works in the private sector until he becomes governor. He doesn't take the traditional path. So he comes to power, comes to get governor in a Vermont, which has been changing pretty dramatically for a lot of reasons over the 60s and 70s. I'll name a couple of the top line things here. A large population influx that started in the 60s, as we touched on before, mostly from the baby boom, but that's still a significant population increase and some in-migration from people working at firms like IBM and so on and so forth, and some people coming to live a counterculture life. He is succeeding Governor Phil Hoff, who was the first Democratic governor of Vermont. It's a big deal. It was a huge result of the reapportionment of the legislature and a sort of political power shift that gave more power to more populated areas, which is proportional representation, which had been mandated by a Supreme Court case in the 1960s. So the legislature had gone from 251 members, one for every town, to proportional representation, which is how we get, whether well, 17 legislative districts in Burlington today, I think, or something
Yeah,
like that.
something like that
Which is,
close.
yeah, which is how we get to the makeup of the legislature today. So a pretty significant power shift, a political power shift. We had also seen a Vermont that was starting to shift. It's starting to lose industrial economic base, which had previously been concentrated in like the Queechee River Valley for weaving and things like that, the Precision Valley, during Springfield, which had made high precision manufacturing, firearms, and among other things, the quarrying at Rutland and Barrie, all that's starting to slow down as for a lot of reasons, right? Big, huge economic reasons. So this is a Vermont that it needs to figure out where it's going forward. It cannot necessarily rely, dairy farms had been going out for a long time. It cannot necessarily rely on the economic base that had powered it for 100 years at that point, maybe even more. You could argue longer. And what is it going to, where is its economic base going to come from going forward? Is it going to, he names in this speech, he makes an assumption in this speech that that population increase is going to continue. He turns out to be wrong. That's a whole nother thing, right? But he makes an, he what he sees in the speech is a future in which there are going to be a lot more people in Vermont than there have been. And how do we balance that with the Vermont that I knew, that I grew up in, that made sense to me and to a whole lot of other people that he's speaking directly to and her because it's gonna, he knows it's going to be different one way or the other, whatever it looks like going forward. And as like all of us, some of the ways in which he sees the future don't come to pass, or they're different from the ways he comes to pass. But generally speaking, he's put his finger on some of the really central. Later on, he lists a couple of like big picture questions about where will, what about these new residents? And arguably, like some of them are still relevant questions today as we think about things like that. How can we continue to enjoy the environment? Like, What about the numbers of people who own second homes in Vermont? Like, will we become an extended suburb of Boston or New York or Montreal? And how are we going to find jobs for everyone? Like, these are deeply fundamental questions at the time. I think they still feel very, very true for us today. So he's coming in a moment of, I mean, arguably, like, is there ever a calm moment in history? It hasn't felt like that way for a while, but he is coming in at like a high point in the background. The Vietnam War is going on, and there's a great deal of debate, and a public feeling, strong feeling on representing every sort of possible point of view on that. In fact, he gets into a spat with his own lieutenant governor. We can talk about that in a bit. So there's an awful lot going on that he has to navigate.
Just to highlight how big the questions were that Dean was asking, or sorry, Davis was asking. A few weeks ago, I was covering a public meeting up in Newport. I was on Zoom, obviously. I didn't go up to Newport, but Newport has just released a new master plan for its downtown, and it's pretty exciting. It looks really interesting. And part of the plan is focusing on housing. How can we take some of these derelict buildings and make them into good housing? And I kid you without fail, someone gets up in the audience and asks the very important question, but an ongoing question of, well, how are we going to make sure this housing is affordable and not just becomes luxury homes for folks from Montreal? So it's like the questions haven't stopped for whatever reason.
And we touched on this before we started today, but so he Act 250 is one of the signature accomplishments. And that's his own, like, I'm not naming that as an historian. He considered that one of the signature accomplishments of his tenure as governor. And he describes in his autobiography, I'm sure there were a lot of things that got him to championing Act 250, and they're all very complicated, but the thing that he chooses to sort of intro his discussion of Act 250 with is a very large proposed housing development in Windham County that the International Paper Company owned a huge tract of land, and they were going to build, he says, 1,400 homes on that land. And it causes, and he like calls, he describes himself calling the CEO of the company at his like cabin in the woods in Canada where he's fishing, and talking him out of it, and then throwing up regulatory burden, talking him out of it, talking him into a delay, and then throwing up all these regulatory burdens to stop the project, and then leading into Act 250. He describes that his whole contention is large scale improper development. Like, he has a very specific view of what proper development is, and that leans a little bit on that, what we described earlier, is maybe that old Vermont way of building with the land or building in certain ways. But I think that the idea today of, frankly, any governor, not just, and much more a Republican governor, calling the CEO of a large company and saying, "Don't you dare build 1,400 houses in Vermont." It's fascinating, so some things feel very business the same, but sometimes you come across, I read that story and I thought, boy, the how would that conversation have gone today? Just feels so different from, as I said, I serve on the Barrie City Council. We're talking all the time right now about housing and bringing in more housing. This is a conversation that every community is having. And for him to say, I stopped this and I'm proud of it, just feels weird.
Well, I'm so glad you shared that because to me it highlights sort of, for lack of a better term, like the two sides of Act 250. Because the other story of Davis in Act 250 is that again, this is the story I grew up on. So take it with a grain of salt. But the story I grew up on was he came down to Windham County to where a lot of the second homes around the ski area were in the process. They were just going up like this. And he saw things like septic, just not even going into a septic tank, just rolling down the hill, and houses built on ledge and not built properly. And he kind of went, oh my gosh, what are we doing to our environment? And I think that is a very legitimate question that Act 250 asks. But then you take the other side of that housing development. And my guess is, I wasn't there, but my guess is that would have been more what we're calling now like workforce housing.
Probably.
But for him to not be for something like that as well, I think some people would argue that's the other side of Act 250, that it sometimes stops development that we actually need. So I think that's fascinating.
And that was, I mean, so I think your story is absolutely accurate as well to his conception of the Vermont. Again, we fall back on that Vermont quality of like the Vermont he was imagining, and the Vermont, I think he's speaking for a lot of people who are imagining this, just to be clear. Like, this is not entirely like only him advancing these things. He's absolutely reflecting a dominant view for many, many people at the time of what a Vermont should be. This is also around the time billboards are banned. This is around the time of the bottle bill. He creates Green Up Day.
Oh, really? I didn't
Yeah,
know
he's
that.
throws
Okay.
pick. Yeah, someone called him up and said, Governor, I keep driving the highway, and I after a spring melt, I see all this trash. And so yeah, he becomes he squires the first green. He closes the highways for 3 hours so that people can green up the highways, and we have all these pictures of him in a hard hat. But those are both, to us, they feel like two sides to him. They are absolutely a sort of contiguous perspective. Like, we want to protect the environment, and part of the way we protect the environment is both like providing for proper housing and also not having too much of it. And it's about your conception of need. What do we need? We would answer that question differently today than he would in a lot of ways.
Yes. Thank you. Which is always, I don't know if other states spend as much time on their identity as Vermont does, but it really does feel like Vermont is asking that question you started at the beginning, like, what makes a Vermonter? What makes Vermont? It does seem like we ask that a lot more than other
Yeah.
places.
So I'll toss this out to you. I have a new favorite quote about Vermont.
Ooh.
And I came across, I was doing some background research for this. It was an overview of all the different commissions and things like that have come. And this a Supreme Court Justice Wendell Phillips Stafford said this while he was testifying before the Vermont Commission on Country Life in 1931. He said, "It is always a perilous thing to let a Vermonter get started on the subject of Vermont."
Oh my gosh, I love it.
Right?
It's like,
Yeah,
hang
feels
on,
very
people.
relevant.
We're going to be here a while.
Yep.
Oh, thank you so much, Amanda. Well, on that note, we need to hear from some underwriters here on WVEW LP Brattleboro. So stay tuned, folks. Amanda and I will be right back.
This hour of programming on WVEW is underwritten in part by All About Trees, an independent, locally owned tree care company. All About Trees professional arborists provide a range of tree care services, including pruning, removals, and structural support installation. All About Trees diagnoses and treats disease and pest problems in trees. Phone 802-579-3084. Web all-about-trees.com. WVEW thanks All About Trees for helping to support community radio.
Today's programming at WVEW is sponsored in part by Shippey Auto, located at 753 Brattleboro Road in Hinsdale, New Hampshire. Independently and locally owned since 1995, Shippey Auto provides automotive repairs, preventative maintenance, fleet services, New Hampshire state inspections, and free loaner cars. Specializing in Subarus and servicing all other SUVs, cars, and trucks, Shippey Auto serves the tri-state area. To learn more, visit shippeyauto.com or call 603-336-5100. WVEW thanks Shippey Auto for supporting community radio.
Gathering
Gallery in the Woods is a proud underwriter of Community Radio WVEW. Celebrating over 20 years at 145 Main Street in Brattleboro, Gallery in the Woods features three floors of art, handcrafts, designer jewelry, and furniture from Vermont and around the world. Our friendly and knowledgeable staff is here to help you. Kids are welcome. There's live music every Saturday from noon to 2 with the Moondogs, who you are hearing in the background. Gallery in the Woods is open from 11 o'clock every day and open anytime at galleryinthewoods.com.
Welcome back to the second half of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW LP Brattleboro. I want to welcome you all back. I'm speaking with Amanda Gustin from the Vermont Historical Society. And before we jump back into our conversation about Dean Davis, the former governor of Vermont, I want to quickly thank BCTV for taking the video version of our show and sharing it with media centers across the state. And since Emily is not here, it falls to me to say that the views and opinions of everyone on the Happy Hour are those of the host and the guest, and not the platforms, not their employers, not the stations, not the media centers. Am I forgetting anyone, Amanda?
I think that's covered it.
That's us. Just us.
Yep. Just the people you hear and see today.
Perfect. So if you're just joining us, folks, Amanda and I have been talking about the farewell speech of the former governor, Dean Davis, which he gave to the assembly in 1973. And we talked a lot about the quality of life and what it means to be a Vermonter in the first half. And we had talked about Act 250, but I would love to segue, Amanda, to some of the economic issues that Dean brings up in his speech. Because as you mentioned, he launched the sales tax, or he spearheaded it. He also talks about balancing the budget. And it was a time in Vermont where the economy was changing. Industry was dying out, farms were kind of dying out. It seems to me, in my own memory, that a lot of the ski areas were probably becoming resorts that we know now. So I would love to talk a little bit more about economy and what was his vision for the economy?
Yeah, so he had in some ways, I guess what you would describe as a traditional, like conservative view of the economy. He talks at great length, and he talks about this in his farewell address. He talks in great length about his autobiography, about how he wanted to balance the budget, that he saw a lot of money being expended on he specifically names education and social programs as two huge drivers of cost, increased cost in the state government. And that hasn't changed.
Yep,
it's the same today. And like sometimes when he does this, he's throwing a little bit of a dig at the previous governor, Democratic Governor Phil Hoff.
Okay.
There's like, sometimes there's that tone, but then he also in the next thing will go, a lot of them are doing really good things. And people are sort of, this is just the way we live in the world now, that this is the way we structure government and the way we help people now. Mm-hmm. But he will come back around to, but the state, you know, we're still spending more than we're taking in terms of income.
Mm-hmm.
So another sort of thing about Dean Davis that we might not expect is he goes in to his inaugural address, like, I'm a brand new governor, I haven't served in all these traditional state government positions before, and his pitch is for a sales tax, saying we need a sales tax in order to balance the state budget, to bring in enough income to fund the programs that we've all gotten used to, that we've all come to rely on. And what he initially proposes is a 4% sales tax with a 20% increase in the corporate tax. And then he also proposes a series of income-sensitive refunds. And he's proposing this in 1969. So his cutoff that he proposed was anyone making $14,000 or less each year will be eligible to apply for refunds on their sales tax. And he sees this in a couple of ways. He saw only two ways to balance the budget, a dramatic increase in personal income tax. And he says that it could have been as much as 30% to really balance the books, which is huge, or the sales tax. Yeah. So he goes with the sales tax, and he specifically puts that refund in because he specifically says without it, a sales tax is regressive. And I don't like that. And he goes on to a whole bit later on where, like, when you strip that out, it does in fact become regressive, and we get afraid of sales taxes because unless you have a counterbalance. So that is a concern for him. One of the things I find really interesting is he describes right before he's about to make this pitch, he calls in the Democratic Minority Leader of the House, the Representative Tom Salmon. This is a Republican, not quite supermajority, but close to supermajority at the time, which was the curse for most of Vermont history. Yeah. But so he calls in the Democratic Minority Leader, Tom Salmon, to get him on board because he knows, and he says this over and over and over again, the people I'm going to have to convince to levy a sales tax are the Democrats.
Which not is a narrative we hear now.
Right. And so I see this is another one of those fascinating, like, shifting moments, right? We think of the American party system writ large nationally as experiencing a couple of big shifts in which ideologies moved around, the certain policies that a certain political party championed or a certain way of being has changed. And we look back and we know that one of those big party shifts occurs in the 1960s. And it results somewhat in the political system that is starting that we live in now, that certainly, you know, you and I have experienced our entire lives to this point. There's some interesting arguments. Are we in the course of another one? We'll know in 50 years, frankly. Right. But a big one happens in the 1960s, and it kind of feels like Vermont has not caught up with that party shift yet. Because it is still following some of those old lines. I mean, I always point out people that Senator George Aiken introduced food stamp benefits as a senator from Vermont at the national level. Republican Senator George Aiken. This is Republican Governor Dean Davis arguing for a 4% sales tax and a 20% increase in the corporate tax with ways to make it less regressive. And he struggles to convince the Democrats in the legislature of this. So eventually he does achieve it. It gets knocked down to a 3% sales tax. The ceiling for who can apply for a refund gets lower. I'm assuming the corporate sales tax passed. I couldn't find that in my research, but he doesn't mention it not passing. Mm-hmm. And he says, I got everything I wanted. So he passes that, and it does in fact balance the state budget.
Okay.
Between that, and he takes them also sort of cost, not cost cutting, but cost containment measures. And it works. It brings in the increased revenue that they needed. It does rebalance the state budget. Even among all of the other sort of things that are happening at this time that are putting upward pressure on the state budget, like an increase in state employees, an increase in sort of regulatory concerns, huge population increases. He goes in at length about how the schools are overcrowded and they have to build more schools. And he actually develops a whole state level program for funding the construction of regionalized high schools.
Interesting.
Yeah. And funding those at the state level. It's a little bit about the building fund that is getting talked about a little bit at the legislature right now. And so he's able to sort of make all of this work.
Okay.
With that sales tax, but he gets a lot of criticism for it. Like, he gets primaried in part because of the sales tax by his own sitting lieutenant governor.
Oh, interesting.
Of the same party. So it's a huge knock on him, but it worked.
Mm-hmm. Were there, how do I want to ask this? Were there other tools in his toolbox as governor when it comes to addressing some of the economic shifts and revenue needs that he could have used that maybe he didn't?
So he does talk a little bit about what he describes as welfare reforms.
Okay.
And so he does employ some of those, but he doesn't go nearly as far. And he describes some pressure to have gone much further. And I think one of them is simply cutting a lot of the benefit programs that had been established previously. And he just very pragmatically says both they're helping people and also politically, I can't touch them. So I think he certainly considered doing that. He doesn't seem to have been, although he comes out of a business background, right? He was general counsel and then president of the National Life Insurance Company. And he was president of the Chamber of Vermont Chamber of Commerce for a while. He doesn't seem to have been like a huge business booster kind of governor.
Okay.
He did something. So it wasn't necessarily a let's juice up the economy style of increased revenue. He actually has a line about like people are willing to pay for things that they see the benefit of. And so the trick is to make them see the benefit.
I'm so sorry, Amanda. My internet froze there for a second.
Okay.
So we heard he's not much of a business booster, okay, juicing up the economy. And then
he relied more on cost containment and revenue increases with sort of a side of finding some reforms within existing programs, but I think he realized the gains on those were marginal at best.
Okay. Interesting. Well, it just always feels, one reason I brought that up is, I suppose too, in that question of what is Vermont, you know, it's a question that impacts our economy as well, because depending on how you answer the question, what is Vermont, may also influence the type of businesses or jobs that that you might find acceptable or not acceptable in your state. So I didn't know if he ever touched on something like that.
Yeah, he talked a little bit about his concerns about the ways property taxes were structured, because he saw a reliance on property tax, and he saw that I'm just describing what he describes.
Yes.
He saw a reliance on property tax as driving land use from agricultural use into developed use, because then you could get, first of all, you were pricing out people who had large amounts of land,
right,
that they had in agricultural use. And also there was then pressure to develop that land to have a higher property tax value that could return a higher revenue. So he had some real concerns about raising taxes through increases in property tax, and similar concerns, somewhat parallel concerns about raising it through personal income tax.
Okay, interesting. So I'm curious, for you, as a historian who's often taking the long view of moments in time, we are approaching a new legislative session, and of course the economy is on the docket. Land use reform is on the docket, housing's on the docket, all these big issues. I'm curious, what kind of context do you put around that? You know, how are you seeing the upcoming session and how some of these pieces may or may not fit together?
Yeah, I think one of the things I was struck by in sort of reflecting on what he got done, he was a two-term governor, right? In his first term, he did sales tax, Act 250, reorganization of the entire state government, which we can talk about in a moment, and just a couple of other sort of decent-sized environmental initiatives and things like that. And so I think sometimes we think today that we're stuck with things, or that we're stuck in a system, or that it's so complicated. And I'm not saying it's not complicated, but I'm saying sometimes we think it's so complicated that we can't make big changes, or that we can't make effective changes. And I think history sort of proves that wrong, that the things that we started talking about this, right? The things that we take for granted, the ways in which the system operates that we take for granted have been that way for so long, and we can't imagine them changing, but they absolutely can and have changed within our own lifetimes, and they've changed in huge ways in our own lifetimes. So it's both really hard to think about changing a system you live inside of. But also I think it brings me a certain amount of comfort to know that that it has changed and that it will continue changing. So you might as well work on the change. You know, it's going to change no matter what. And this has been the case throughout Vermont history, right? Mm-hmm. There's never been, and I think the other thing too is that, you know, we talked about this a little bit too. What is the Vermont quality of life? There has never been a moment in Vermont history when everything has just balanced and worked, right? We've been talking about school consolidation and the challenges of that since the 1860s. We have been talking about selling people second homes in Vermont and the loss of family farms since the 1870s. We've been talking about people fleeing, quote unquote, the state of Vermont and leaving the state of Vermont, and they are losing our young people since the 1820s. right? There's never been like a thing that we can get to or return to, for that matter, where all the pieces matched up neatly, and if we just tweak this thing and get this thing right, it will all work out. That has never existed, and frankly, it never will exist, right? So I think this, it's not to say we shouldn't be working on making everything work for all Vermonters, but there's not like there's a perfect answer out there or a perfect template out there. People have just done the things that they can do, done the things that they're able to do, done within their power and their ability and their strength to do throughout human history. And that's something I find very comforting.
Thank you, Amanda. You know, based on what you just said, I think I have new appreciation for, because not everyone approaches a system the same way, and not everyone is helped or hindered by that system in the same way. And so I have new appreciation for what you were sharing about how Davis got people on side or not. You know, that might actually be the important discussion in history is not whether the systems can change, but who came along and how did you get them to come along so they could change?
And so he tells a story in his autobiography about the sales tax, of how he's running for re-election. He's getting hammered for the sales tax. He describes like cashiers counting out change and saying, oh, and that'll be 50 cents for Governor Davis. Setting aside, right? He describes just getting hammered by it. And he had someone who worked on his campaign had this idea for an ad. And so they put him out in an actual physical leaky boat on Lake Champlain, I think it was, on a lake somewhere. And they made him in like ratty clothes bail out the boat. And they filmed him doing this. And then the voiceover said, he's bailing out our budget. And they would describe with each bucket, he's bailing out this piece of it. And they were naming things that people liked. They were naming popular programs, right? And I was spending some time this morning with a friend of mine who remembers watching this like real time. And I said, I'm talking about Governor Davis this afternoon. And he said, oh yeah, Mr. Sales Tax, he's bailing out our budget like 50 years later. And that was immediately his memory. So this commercial airs and he describes like overnight getting flack from getting flack at his like local grocery store about you made me do this to a little kid coming up to him and saying, thank you for bailing out our budget, which is wild, right? Like it's one political commercial, but it worked. It was a message, a moment, and a way of making people sort of connect with what was happening. And so I think from that I take, sometimes it's a small thing that tips people over into understanding or realizing. And sometimes he describes it as humor working too, because it was kind of funny to see your governor in ratty clothes, like frantically bailing out a boat. And like, so yeah, sometimes it is that small. It doesn't have to be a huge, massive, like years long. Like sometimes there's a tipping point and you can find it. I don't know. He describes like he actually didn't want to run the commercial. His people talked him into it.
Oh,
so he didn't even
interesting.
Know it could quite work. But he really describes it as that. And it's a visible tipping point, right? Like things have been growing in the background as always happens. But I think about that and I think it doesn't always have to be this huge thing. Sometimes it's just a slightly funny commercial that makes people get it.
Yeah.
It also helps to have a singular media environment and all those other things. But you know.
Yeah, so the majority of people saw it.
Right.
Right.
Right. So
yeah, that's a whole other discussion.
Right. But, you know, the moment in which it existed and all that, it worked.
Well, I suspect there was a lot of authenticity in the ad too, because if they put him out on a lake in a truly leaking boat, he was probably bailing really hard.
Oh, he says at one point they actually were like discussing something and not even filming and no one told him, and he's starting to freak out because the boat's actually starting to sink. So yeah, there was an element of realism there.
Well, on that note, Amanda, I know you need to go to a Barry Council meeting. So before we head out, what would you like to leave listeners with today?
I'm a huge fan of Dean Davis. I think he is a fascinating political figure to study in Vermont. I think that reflecting on the ways in which he served Vermont over the entire course of his life. You know, he was in his 20s when he started as an attorney in the city of Barrie and as a city councilor, and he spent truly his entire life serving in some capacity or another. And then I'm sure he had an ego, right? Like you, but it doesn't really come across as much, and it doesn't necessarily come across in the policies he pursues and the actions he takes, nor in his kind of very self-deprecating sense of humor, nor in the way he writes about them. And I appreciate that. I think that kind of thoughtful pragmatism, that kind of sense of humor, that kind of getting people on board. He really faced a really tough re-election fight, and the thing he said I really loved that night was hearing what my opponent said about me and how he thought well of me, and that was what was important to me. And I think sometimes we use those as cliches and as this is the thing we're supposed to say,
right?
But I feel like he meant it, and I think the more of that we infuse in our public service, the better. I'm really proud he's from Barrie. I think that's really cool. He went to the school that's like a block away from my house now. He served on city council the same way I do now, and I think that feels real in a really cool way.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. You know, you mentioned that you were reading his autobiography. If anyone's curious, could you tell us the title? I think you have it right there.
Yeah, it's called Dean C. Davis, An Autobiography. It's not the most creative.
But you won't forget it either.
No. He actually wrote a couple of books. He wrote two memoirs of life as he describes as a country lawyer. Before that, he was city attorney for the city of Barrie. He actually was the guy enforcing the Volstead Act around Prohibition.
Oh, wow. So
he's got stories. he was a Washington County State's attorney. He was an attorney in private practice. And so on. So he already had a very colorful, he actually notes, he was elected governor at 69 years old, which he says was quite elderly at the time. Like that was considered like, whoa, it's older for a governor, which is again, maybe a little bit different of how we think about the ages of people serving in office today. So I would definitely check it out. It's fairly readily available, I would expect, at most libraries.
Thank you very much. Well, Amanda Gustin from the Vermont Historical Society, thank you for joining us today. If people want to learn more about your work at the Society, where can they go?
Yeah, check out vermonthistory.org, all spelled out, all one word. The Vermont Historical Society is the state's independent nonprofit historical society. We're based in Barrie and Montpelier, and we do education programs, support for local historical societies. We keep the state's historic collections, both archival and museum object, in trust. We have a museum in Montpelier and a research center in Barrie, and we keep busy. So there's many, many things that you can listen to, read, or dig into that you can access through the website.
It's a very robust website. I like it very, very much. As always, the Montpelier Happy Hour is on WVEW LP Brattleboro every Friday at 2, rebroadcasted on Wednesday mornings. If you ever want to reach out to us, you can look wherever you subscribe to your podcasts, at our Captivate page, or you can drop us an email at themontpelierhappyhour@gmail.com. Take care, everyone, and have a good weekend.